I went in the closet earlier today, but I did come out again. But in the closet, in my suitcase, I found this that I had forgotten I had packed many weeks ago for this retreat in the bottom of my suitcase. And looking for intimate things in my suitcase, this came out. So, would you there or at the feet of the Buddha? Or wrapping the Buddha? However you want, in your creative way, Anushka. Better late than never. So I thought this afternoon that it could be good to visit together one of the essential teachings of Buddhism, of the Buddha, and see, you know, if it if we can recognize in there some truth, recognize our experience, either here on retreat or the experience in our life. I thought about this because yesterday Anushka was talking about dukkha, and I thought, oh, that could be a good way in the. Also, or a good way to follow with the Four Noble Truths, and that's what's coming. Actually, this is the first teaching that I personally was I received. First time I encountered Buddhism was at least orally in a retreat. The first night I was on a retreat, I think, or that's how I remember it. That's what was presented, and that's how, for me, I had this sense of coming home. You know, there was a recognition. Oh, this sounds so right. You know, it was the beginning of a practice for me that is still going on many years later. In the description of the Four Noble Truths, for me there was healing, there was a kind of a liberation, liberated from false views that I had. And there was definitely a taste of something wise, right, onward leading, liberating, all these words. So the Four Noble Truths, we could think of the Buddha as the great doctor. So the first truth is him talking about the symptoms of the disease we're experiencing. And then the second truth is the diagnosis. You know, what's the cause of this? And then the third truth is the I don't know if it's the right word, prognosis. No? Like, what are the chances of getting out of the trouble, of healing, the prognosis. And then the fourth truth is the prescription. And it says that awakening, we use that term, is basically a deep understanding of these truths in an experiential way, in the, you know, from the inside, knowing it for oneself, you know. And in a way, what we do here, what we've been doing the whole week, is getting closer, getting close to these truths in different ways, you know, and maybe recognizing them. And it might not be, might not have been in these terms, you know, oh, this is the second one, this is the first one, or it might have been, if you know that this presentation, but as this is being described, you might recognize, oh yeah, I've recognized this. I didn't name it exactly like that, but yeah, I know that experience. And so the first truth was actually very well presented yesterday by Anushka, and it's the truth of dukkha. There is dissatisfaction, there is stress, there is suffering, there is separation from what is dear, there is being stuck with what is unwanted, you know. And to me, the breadth of the presentation of dukkha is what's the most impressive. And I think I was reading Bhikkhu Bodhi, was online, is free, and you can buy also this book. Is it called The Noble Eightfold Path, I think. Anyway, it's so very, very thorough, very good reading. And in that, he was saying, like, if I'm going to go see a doctor, I want a really good one. You know, I want a doctor that, I'm putting this in my words, I want a doctor that can really, really tell what's not right, you know, what's hard, and really go to the source, to the real cause, like not stop halfway down, you know. Like, I want somebody who can really see what's not going right and go to, and I want somebody who can tell me really, honestly, if there can be healing and exactly how, you know. And in this way, the Buddha would be the great doctor because he does this. And to me, what's impressive in the description of dukkha is how thorough it is. I remember seeing a play many years ago in Montreal. It was a theater company from England, coming with their English humor. And the name of their company is Forced Entertainment. And they were exploring entertainment. What's the edge of entertainment? You know, what is entertaining and what suddenly is not anymore? And so part of this was the length of the play. The length of the show was, several hours. You know, and already there you could see like, oh, for me, an hour 55 minutes is entertaining. You know, beyond that, and so that's, I think it's a really interesting thing to go see, like, what is entertaining and what is not? And so there was one weird number after the other, exploring entertainment, and mostly the edge of it. And in the first act that came, this person came in front and I said, welcome everyone, please, relax. I hope you enjoy yourself. We're here to entertain you. And so please do not think about the things that are difficult in your life. You know, already there, that's really weird. you actually make me think of it, you know. Don't think about anything that is difficult for you, you know. And then this person proceeded in naming everything that is difficult. And it went on for like 20 minutes and people were leaving, you know, the room. And, and I remember, like, they were naming everything. It was really thorough. And at some point, for example, at the very beginning, this person said, we're here in Montreal, downtown, corner of St. Catherine and St. Laurent. In the whole of Canada, the insurance companies say that it's the worst place for car stealing. So if you're parked around here, please don't think about this. That will ruin your evening. You know, and then they went on, everything medical, everything relational, everything to do with work, everything to do with, you know, global stuff, society, culture, you know. And they kept going, and in a way you have to be pretty solid to stay there, you know. And they were kind of waves, you know, you would like be visited by despair and then laughter because it was such a weird situation. And they kept going, you know, very slowly, kind of mindfully naming, you know. And after I thought they named everything. And later, a few days after, I thought, actually, no. That was just like one third. If you look at Buddhist view of dukkha, you know. And so they were naming dukkha, what is clearly difficult. There's no doubt about this. You know, we won't fret or debate about this. You know? And then they were leaving out what was the dukkha, the difficulties of the ephemerality of things, you know, things beautiful ending, and us being aware of this, you know. You know, I don't know if the retreat might be in the dukkha realm for you, or it might be in the kind of anicca dukkha, the, you know, oh, it's gonna end, you know. And that's, to me, already very, very poignant, that the nature of reality is that we live in a reality where things can escape, will finish. You know, and knowing this, and to me, these teachings, I'm thinking now, maybe all these teachings that we've been looking at this week, that's pretty much how I understand, all these teachings are leading straight to tenderness. You know, when you become aware that this is our experience, that there's difficulties to meet, and things that are beautiful, but they vanish. You know, encounters finish. You know, what comes together comes apart. You know, health. You think, oh, I might have relative health right now. You know, it's going to change. And so here we come to come closer to this, to actually experience it, not hear about it, but experience it in reality. And I remember one time I was sitting a long retreat, and I think it was a 3-month retreat at the Insight Meditation Society. And towards the end of the retreat, very close to Christmas, I was walking in the woods, and the mind was really, really calm and connected. You know, like it was... Things were very vibrant, almost like as if I was in an enchanted forest. But the main ingredient was the quality of the mind that was there, you know. And there was a snow falling, and then there was a really something unique happened with wind and snow and light and the play of light. It's been so long that I don't even remember what it was. I just remember that I was there and I was thinking, this might be the most beautiful thing I'll ever see in my life. And this I will probably never see again. Even it was taking particular conditions. I didn't know what they were, but you know, all of them. But there was some kind of you know, snow twisting in the ray of light with the wind, but several of these things twisted, like totally magical. And I was there, and I was seeing what, to me at that point, and again probably today, is one of the most beautiful things I ever saw. And it was happening. The most beautiful thing was happening. And I knew it would finish. I knew I could not share it with other people. You know, I didn't have time to go get people to see this, because you know, you had to be there, because it was just there for a few seconds, you know, it would change. And then it did change, you know. And there was something deeply touching for me. I was like, oh, I've just been exposed, is that the right word?
Mm-hmm.
To, you know, kind of a ultimate kind of beauty for the eyes, you know? And it didn't solve, you know, like it was beautiful, but it didn't totally do it. It was very touching to notice this. It was really beautiful, but it was also going, gone, and not absolutely satisfying. And so that's kind of a one particular aspect of dukkha, you know, is even the most beautiful thing can't actually do it completely. To me, that was a kind of an insight. Wow. So I might, all my life, want things like this, you know, but now, with the quality presence, I was exposed to beauty. It was deeply touching, yet it didn't solve the human problem, you know. How amazing is that? And this was leading right then and there to some kind of compassion for the human predicament, you know. Wow, things are not going to be satisfying in this deep or sustainable, perfect way, you know. But they are going to, you know, there's going to be gratification and beauty and sense and meaning and richness. But everything being in flux. And so maybe, yeah, it brought some compassion, but also a lot of curiosity for the human predicament. So how to inhabit human life, you know, if even this event is not going to do it, you know. And so in the description of dukkha, it seems to say that everything that is compounded, made of something else, constructed, dependent, contingent on something else, is shaky, unreliable, you know, because it depends on conditions. Can change, and often it's not changing, but yet we know that it could. We don't even need it to change, just the knowledge that it could makes us a little stressed. Do you know what I mean? You know? Or if there's something we want because it seems like it's going to be satisfying, and it becoming aware that we don't have control over all the conditions, that it might actually not happen, although it would be fair, just, beautiful, wouldn't hurt anybody else, you know. The fact that it might not exactly be able to come together is a particular situation to find ourselves in, huh? So an experience of lack of control, that we can't control somebody else's happiness, you know. It's only beautiful to want somebody else to be happy or safe. And human beings, we don't have, you know, control over this. So, and again, for me, wow, leads straight to compassion, tenderness. Of course, it could lead to, you know, anger. It could lead to cynicism. It could lead to giving up, you know, but that would only add to the problem. So that's what we're coming here to clarify. Oh, if life is like this, then I hate it. Hating it is the second arrow. Not only is life difficult, but hating it is not solving the problem at all. You know, being resentful towards it is just aggravating. Do you agree with that? You know, so what's the way out? This becomes a real question. You know, if I'm going to hate it, it doesn't work so well. If I desire something else, another life where it happens as I want, you know, let's try this then. We're not going to hate life. We're going to dream of a life where we have control, where we know what's coming, where beauty stays, where, you know, comfort or safety remains, you know, stable, reliable. Let's dream of that. Sages have said this is very difficult too, because that's not the nature of reality. So you're going to kind of chase hope for something that won't provide, you know, won't happen. What to do then? And so that's how I understand the teachings for me. It's saying, well, one of the ways to meet this wisdom, wise and wise way, is care, tenderness, capacity to meet, stabilizing the heart or making it courageous, you know, so that it can actually meet uncertainty, powerlessness. And of course there are not the only features of life, you know, there is creativity, there is agency, there's a lot of things at play. But these are definitely part of the deal, I think, powerlessness. And yeah, how to meet this? To me is why I would come in a place like here, to actually become aware of the nature of reality and then learn how to hold it, you know. And so the teaching of Dukkha seems to say anything of the world, not a thing of the world, can absolutely do it. But I thought, you know, the next relationship will be it. Mm-hmm. I thought you would be it, and I'm finding out you're not. Or you are, but I'm aware that you could go, you could, you know, life, disease, death, you know. Wow, very, to me it's extremely poignant. So this is the breath of naming the problem. And then the cause is really, in a way, surprising. You would say, you would think the cause is that it's not as I wanted, but the cause that the Buddha named seemed otherwise, seemed other. Seemed to have said the cause of the trouble here, the real trouble, is an event that happens in the mind-heart. It's something that happens and can not happen. Possibility of freedom here. So what is the cause of our suffering? Clinging. It's a mental event, a kind of... So clinging, it could be in this way, like wanting it to be otherwise, clinging to the idea that it should be otherwise, it should have been otherwise. I should feel in a different way. You know, so clinging with a kind of a grasping desire, greed, you know, this very, very painful. There's many descriptions of this one event, you know, so it's, you know, there was a clarification for me also in that. It was like, this is one thing, the cause is one thing, clinging. It's not like, oh, the causes of suffering is the neighbor on the left. The employer, society, that particular institution, you know, like, there are not many causes, you know. It says there's one. It's a mental event. And so therefore there's something to do that can be done about it. And that's why we come here, to check what is clinging, what is non-clinging. So I'm going to try here to describe a few ways that we cling. And so there is clinging to experience of the senses. So when something is delicious, beautiful, often the mind will cling, want to keep, want to get more of, you know. And that's painful. It actually cuts the ability to feel and enjoy, be touched, be nourished by what is good, you know. Because, you know, so, I don't know, you get good feedback from somebody. Could be at work or in a relationship. You know. Oh, I love when you do this, or you did this well, you know. And often we can't actually totally feel it, or we feel it for a second, we're like, but can I keep this up? You know, will everybody agree? You know, will others see it? That I did good, you know? Do you see what I mean? How the mind will cling like this? And it clings also to what is disagreeable often. Not always. And that's what we come here to check out, you know? How does it feel when we cling? And how does it feel when we don't? And so, you know, when something is hard, often we'll keep it, you know. You know, in 87, when you said this, I remember. I don't remember what exactly you said, but I remember. What is it you said? I'm still angry anyway. And so, in a way, we haven't seen that the thing has passed. We haven't noticed. Because with our idea, we made it solid, and we kept it, in a way, cherished it. It's only natural we would do that. You know, there's probably biological reasons for that. But we're pushing a little further here, the investigation, the exploration, you know. So here we come and we create silence and tension to see at some point, oh, look at this thing. There is clinging. There's the mind got hooked on this and is kind of fascinated by this. It can't, it doesn't have the discernment to see that it's gone, you know. So it's still, you know. And a big part of what we do is just sit here and keep realizing that it's okay here now. Okay here now. You know, these people are not here, these things are not happening, they're mind-made, you know. And so a lot of the practice, I think, is just, oh, here, the body's sitting. It's not actually happening, you know. So in this way we cling, sense pleasure, experiences of the senses. Oh, back then, you know, it was so good. We didn't know, we don't know deeply the ephemeral nature of things. They do arise and they pass. No! Back then it was so fun, you know. It is gone, you know, it is gone. Can we actually let it go, you know, instead of keep hoping, you know, that it's somewhere accessible or should be, you know. And so there's a lot of cleaning, I'll use that word, I hope it works, you know, to do around these things here. That's why it takes a few days, it takes many days, you know, to actually release things. It's a very touching process. Oh, it's gone. It's really gone. Can it be okay that it's gone? Oh, it was disagreeable. It was hard. Can it be okay that it did happen? You know? Not easy what I'm talking about. Not easy at all. You know? But the Buddha seems to have said, you know, I would not talk about it if it was not possible to do this work. If it was not possible, I would just shut up and be busy with something else, you know. But I take all this time to talk about it because it's possible to clear the heart in this way and have this kind of discernment about the, you know, changing nature of things. Something else that we cling to, check this out, is that true for you? Is to views and opinion. Somebody on this side clings. Not on that. And so that's an interesting field of practice, even to bring it in our daily lives, you know. When, you know, I can't remember where I read this or something, but it was about our views and opinion in the, you know, can, maybe should, let's try should lead to calm and clarity. Do your views and opinion lead to calm and clarity, or they lead to agitation and lack of sleep and resentment? And so that's, to me, there's a whole field of the Four Noble Truths here. You know, the cause of the distress here might be the clinging to the opinion. You know? And it's not like we shouldn't have opinion. The Buddha, if you ask me, had tons of opinions. You know, 45 years of sharing opinions. You know, I think this is how it works, this, check it out, you know. No, it doesn't work like this, this is how it works, you don't understand well, you know. Many opinions about life, but maybe two things about these opinions. They were not clung to, and he would say, even no passion about dispassion, you know. No, don't get uptight about letting go, you know, about, you know, selflessness or non-self, or don't, you know, not clinging even to what is the, you know, not even clinging to the path. You would say the path, you know, is a raft to cross the flood of overwhelming emotions, the flood of, you know, all the conditionings we receive, and self, the flood of self-hatred and self-loathing, and this flood of doubt and uncertainty. You know, how did I cross the flood? Well, without forcing, without abandoning, that's a good one. But you would say the raft, you know, once you get to the other side, you can't keep carrying the raft, you know, don't cling to the raft. So this field of so his opinion, apparently he was not clinging to them, they were not making him suffer, you know. Plus they were wise views. So we come here to practice both not clinging but also correcting our view of the world, you know. And what I'm describing here could serve as a correcting of the view if you recognize the truth in this. Oh, it's true that stuff can't actually completely provide because it's somewhat shaky. Health is shaky. Relationships, in a way, are. You know, people change their mind. They change. They get sick. They die. You know, all of these things. And so yesterday I was talking about Bell Hooks and how she was holding views in that particular interview, you know, where there was, it seems like her view were leading to calm, clarity, even love and joy was present in the thing. It's like, wow, that's remarkable. Like most people I know, their views don't lead to clarity and calm. You know, leads to being annoying in some ways, you know. So, there's another area of clinging. Again, check this out. And, the Buddha's teaching is presented to clinging to rites and rituals. Rites and rituals. It could be the thought of conventions. And in this context here, that's definitely how I think of it. Anyways, in terms of clinging to norms, you know, and see the suffering in society, clinging to the norms of how, you know, of the gender norms, you know, like such clinging, you know, that, you know, ready to kill for that, you know, or attack, be aggressive, and so we can see this in the world and maybe in ourselves, how we cling to norms and, you know, like, what is homophobia? It's clinging to norms, you know. a person of this gender should love a person of this gender, you know, and if it doesn't, I'm going to freak out, you know, I'm going to be uncomfortable, I'm going to tolerate it, but, you know, and all these things, you know, there's no fluidity around this, you know, there's no, and so we live in a world where there's a lot of clinging to norms. In this particular listing of the types of clinging we do, so sense, pleasure, experiences of the senses, views and opinion, norms, and the last one is cling. That's a big one. That's a big, rich field of exploration and of suffering. Here is clinging to things as I or mine. Oh, we just fell in the heart of the Buddhist thought and practices. You know, so how we appropriate, make mine things that don't belong exactly to moi, and we're mistaken. It's a mistaken view. So we cling to a mistaken understanding of reality, and then we suffer. And so this is like rampant and latent and, you know, in all kinds of ways. So which one will I name here? Well, anything that, let's start with material things. This is mine, this is I. I'm not talking about on a relative level. So there's different levels of this. We can agree this is yours, this is mine. But ultimately, like in an absolute way, is anything material really yours? Yes! Not if I take it. If I take it, if I don't agree with that convention, conventional reality, relative reality, if I don't agree with this, I take it, it'll become clear it was not yours. Well, let not put me in the place of the one who breaks the agreement here. But, you know, these agreements are, you know, they're broken all the time, you know. In Montreal, I don't know how many times I've owned a bike. You know, and somebody has generously came to open my eyes about ownership. Say, you can't own that, you know. And, you know, and for me, one of the major one I told you about is that day in the doctor's office when he said, oh, you thought Alf was yours. It was not yours. It belonged to the conditions, and the conditions have changed. You know, so health is gone. You know, that's a big shock. You know, because I was clinging to a view and a wrong one. This is mine forever. I'm in control of that. Well, no, not exactly. You know, is it your memory? Not exactly. It's memory. You know, and you know sometimes it's flinching a bit. It's starting to. You know, and it might actually vanish completely. It does. It will, in a way. And so this also is very, very poignant for me to become aware of this. Nothing is absolutely mine. You know, things belong to conditions. And so this brings compassion, but also it can bring a deep release. Oh, not mine, you know. And what we're learning to do here, my sense of it, is not to own even more, but it's to take care of. Oh, there's fear. It's not mine, but it's definitely there. What do we do? Oh, there's ache. What do we do with this? Oh, there's joy. You know, joy is of the public domain. Sometimes on this side, sometimes on that side, you know. And it cannot be absolutely owned, you know. I'm a joyful person. Really? What happened when they told you the plane was delayed? Or the company went bankrupt? You know, where was the joyful person? You know, gone there. Yeah. You know? And so what we're talking is at a more subtle level. You know, it's not to say I can't use this word mine or me, but yes, I can. But as the Buddha said, you know, I know the limit of that language. Yes, I use that language, but I know the limit. I'm aware. Because otherwise it would be really painful. You know, I'd be very confused. But I want it to be mine. I thought it was mine. You know. No, it's there. We take care of it. You know? And with this practice of not letting go of the habit of defining, identifying absolutely with anything, with this, there's I think the fear of death maybe slowly is released. You know, because we pay attention moment by moment, and we discover that the person walking in the field earlier is gone. There was the death of that one, you know. And the one who was thinking about this or that is also gone. Now there's this one. Wait just a few minutes. This one will be gone also. There'll be another moment, mind moment experience there. So this is a rich field, that the clinging to things as self, I, mine, you know, is very, very rich. Years of investigation there. So the teaching says that things are fabricated, they depend on other things to appear. And what we learn to do is to take care of these things. There's a friend, Marlon Barrios Solano, who works at, amongst many things, works at the Insight Meditation Society. He's one of the cooks there. But he's also a dancer and a kind of an academic around movement and dance. He was telling me a few months ago that he was somewhere doing a workshop in voguing. There's many, I think it was a gathering of queer artists and exchanging practices, you know? And there was a voguing performer who was teaching, and he said he gave the most beautiful teaching on non-self, which we call sometimes emptiness, empty of the core, absolute self. You know, things are conditioned, constructed, you know. And he said, I don't know, it's like somebody was kind of on a catwalk and he was coaching them in the voguing, you know, and he was saying something like, you can be absolutely fabulous because the other you, the boring you, is not you either. It's all constructed, you know? So you can totally, inhabit fabulousness, you know? Like, don't, you can claim it, you can, you know, you can play with it, it can become your fluid identity for a few moments. I'm putting it in my words, but Marlon was saying, this, like, blew my mind in terms of, like, opening the gate, you know? Like, there is a fluidity possible in the expression of self, you know, because we're not one thing only, you know. In this way, I'm thinking of another friend, trans man, who was telling me, I think something happened, and he said, oh my God, like, I've been socialized as a girl, you know, so this kind of training, conditioning comes up all the time. You know, I'll do these things because I've been trained. There's been a training. It's been, you know, put in there. This is you, this is you, this is you. And we start believing this, you know. And here we can actually clarify these things. That's a deep, deep sense of integrity and the clarity of like, hold on, what are the conditionings that I received from society that are just that, conditionings? They're actually not in line with, you know, what I care for, what I feel, what is vibrant here. How do I take care of what's here? Oh, so what's here is this. Let's honor that. Let's honor that. So there's many ways to talk about this second truth through these kinds of clinging to be, clinging not to be, clinging to have, you know, desire to have, to be. All these ways that we get in trouble, get caught. There's one particular kind of clinging and identification to that particular kind of clinging, which is identifying, defining ourselves through something. That when I went to teach in the Netherlands in November, really struck me. So in one of the museums there that I went to visit, there was an installation from Louise Bourgeois, who's a French artist, very known, respected. And in the room there, there was a big cage. So it's a piece of art. Huh? So there's a big cage. Maybe it was taking all the space here in the middle. And in the middle of the cage, there's a cage. The door of the cage is open. And in the middle of the cage, there is, if you come in the room from a distance, you see there's a being there. It's a human being. And when you come closer, you see, what is that? Because there's actually legs, human beings' legs, size of legs, like this. And the body is a big turd. Like classic, you know, almost emoticon-like turd. You know? And the turd seems to be looking at itself in the mirror. There's a mirror there. There's very little in the cage. There's the cage, door open. The turd can't see the door is open because fascinated by its own image in the mirror. To me, that was so freeing to see. You know, wow, look at that. You know, this is a mind construction. Right? Louise Bourgeois imagined this. She created, it's a mind construction. You know, and to me, I look at this, I said, this is many of us. We've built a self, it's a creation of the mind, it's an unworthy one, it's a piece of shit, and we're fascinated by it, we keep referring to it, it's the one unit of measure, you know. Everything is in line, you know, from that view, you know. And we're fascinated, we can't actually look around to see. What would we discover? A little of looking around, we would discover that the door is open. We're not caught in the cage. You know? A little more investigation, we would discover that this is made up. It doesn't exist. There's no real cage. You know, it's an artist thought about this. You know, you can probably lift the thing if you, you know, there's not even a turd if you look closer. It's just material, whatever you call it, cloth, you know, stuffed. It's made up by a mind, you know. And to me, that's represent our experience of a lot of us. We're there, yeah, but I'm never gonna, you know. It's a construction of the mind, but we can't actually look away. We're fascinated. And so when we come to retreat, to me, that's exactly what we do. We become aware. Oh, look at that creation. wow, I was enamored with a generation of the mind. Of course, you know, religion pointed to that, suggested that, you know, in some ways, and the family did, maybe, and the society, if it was not really covered by everybody else, make sure, you know, in some ways, you know. And so we come here to free this view. It's not easy to do. But, you know, and some of us, maybe we think, I'm the best turd around. You know, so there's some clarification to do also. You know, I'm a better turd. And I thought, when I saw this, I thought of a Zen master, and she would say this, me, this turd at the center of the universe. Not as a description of reality, but the description of the view, of the wrong view. That's important to get this, you know. It's a made-up story. And so here we come to maybe start to have tenderness towards the, you know, release the clinging to that false view and start to laugh at its own. The third noble truth is the doctor saying, actually we can heal this completely. It's possible to put an end, uproot greed, hatred, and delusion. It's possible to clarify things completely. And anything before that, you know, any kind of release before that, it's possible to do this. And then the fourth noble truth is the prescription. Honey, listen well. Here's what you're going to do. You know? And that's what we call the Noble Eightfold Path, or the practice that we've been doing here this week, is that. So there's an aspect of not harming each other and ourselves. You know, protecting, offering protection, so that our mind can be a little bit more at ease. And there's an aspect of developing the heart and mind, that's what we've been doing, sitting and walking. There's an aspect of developing wisdom. The talks are meant for that. The practices we do are meant for that, to see more clearly what is what. Make peace with an unstable world. And so maybe one, just one aspect of the path here, the harmlessness that will lead onward towards liberation, freeing of the mind that is stuck and encaged and preoccupied. Mm-hmm. And so that comes from the Manzanita village. And in Manzanita village, there's two teachers, Catriona Reed and Michelle Benjamin Mickey. Catriona is a trans woman, and Michelle is an artist, is an amazing visual artist, and I think she's an Aikido master also.
Some kind of martial arts.
Yeah, I've seen a few videos of her, like, whoa, incredibly beautiful and precise. Anyway, so they have a retreat center in the south of California, and so they wrote their precepts, you know, the five trainings that we talked about on the first evening of non-harming. They reframe them, and so let yourself hear this. Aware of the violence in the world and of the power of non-violent resistance, I stand in the presence of the ancestors, the earth, and future generations, and vow to cultivate the compassion that seeks to protect each living being. Aware of the poverty and greed in the world, and of the intrinsic abundance of the earth. I stand in the presence of the ancestors, the earth, and future generations, and vow to cultivate the simplicity, gratitude, and generosity that have no limits. Aware of the abuse and lovelessness in the world, and of the healing that is made possible when we open to love, I stand in the presence of the ancestor, the earth, and future generations, and vow to cultivate respect for the beauty and erotic power of our bodies. Aware of the falsehood and deception in the world, and of the power of living and speaking the truth, I stand in the presence of the ancestors, the earth, and future generation, and vow to cultivate the ability to listen, and clarity and integrity in all I communicate by my words and actions. Aware of the contamination and desecration of the world, and of my responsibility for life as it manifests through me, I stand in the presence of the ancestors, the earth, and future generations, and vow to cultivate discernment and care in what I take into my body and mind. So quite powerful. Hard to talk about after this. And so we come here to learn how to meet the world, how to not hurt ourselves and others, how to honor what's alive in here and wants to express itself. Maybe in the world of our dear sister Mary Oliver, dear queer sister. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things. To love what is mortal, to hold it against your bone, knowing your own life depends on it, and when the time comes, to let it go. Let it go. Through non-harming, through mind and heart development, as we are doing here, through the development of wisdom, we are actually learning to protect ourselves and protect others, to support ourselves and support others. And it's an act of generosity to do this towards ourselves and others. Generosity in the teachings is one of the central aspects, one of the pillars of this generosity. And here this week we've been practicing it in many ways, you know, through the, you know, giving rides to each other, to the jobs that we've done, through the showing up. You know, we became literally pillars for each other, you know, showing up again at the sitting. Maybe not for us, but to support others in doing that at different times for us, and at different times for others, and at other times led by others. You know, how many times have I come back to the hall because all the zombies were coming back, you know? Otherwise I would have escaped, you know. But you know, there was this, yeah, I'm gonna come also, it's not easy to do this, but I'm gonna show up. We show up for each other. And so I want to take a moment just here before dinner to talk about a particular aspect of the relationship we have together, the play of the generosity embedded in the retreat, and it's the dana towards the teacher and the manager. And so, as you know, I think it's been well conveyed in the literature, the website, and the letters you got, that during the retreat, the teachers are not supported by the organization to financially. You know, they're brought here, they're fed. That's kind of very minimal in terms of them delivering the goods. You know? You bring them here, you keep feeding, you give them a bed. You know, so they could actually share the teachings, and that's what the organization does. You know? And similarly for Kate here, and so in this tradition, we offer the support, and there's been support that's been offered to us to be here. You know, so you, maybe in the past, and others have supported us so we can be here today. You know? And there's always this kind of mystery: is it gonna keep going? You know. So we rely for staying alive. We need shelter. As you know, it's finding shelter and keeping shelter is not easy. We need to be clothed and receive medicines and care, you know, medical care, and also food. And this is kind of ongoing. There's no end to this. Well, there's an end, but during lifetime, and it takes resources. And so, very humbly, I bring this up for our consideration. It's a very, very vulnerable thing to do. Actually rely on people. It's also a very beautiful thing to do because, you know, all we live with has been generously offered, and the English word lacks here, but it's resting on consideration and care, and it's been working up to now. It's extremely fragile. The teachers have to go where they're supported. You know? So we see many teachers decide to go towards corporations. We value these kinds of setting. And is it possible to keep doing it? Is always a question. So voilà. What's going on. And so the beauty also of the dana system here, of not charging for the teaching, it makes it a little bit more democratic. Right? So it means we can be in different situations, maybe and be here. You know, some of us are in transition, some of us in with disability, some of us, there's so many ways we're here, and some of us have more means. And so we all have access to the teachings, and we have different resources. And so honoring this, how are we going to participate in this? It's absolutely done freely. We're talking about this because it's part of the culture. It's important that we are all aware of it together, you know, as a community. And and then you'll see what is the way you want to participate in this, contribute. In the teaching it says that there is three occasions for an expansive mind state, for a joyful mind state, is being inspired by the teaching, being touched. Wow, the gratitude that can come from that, and being inspired to actually keep the teachings alive. You know, so, wow, this has 2,600 years. It seems like it would be valuable if it stayed alive. You know? And so being inspired to participate, and then having participated, contributed in the way that we've done here with the practice this week, and in the other ways, the dana being the one of the ways, then we can actually rejoice. I'm keeping this alive, I've kept this alive, and I've participated. So these are some of the reflections that you might have around this. I notice for myself that if I, in any situation, if I give too little of my time or my consideration or my resources or my abilities, or if I give too little, I'm not going to feel good. If I give too much, I'm not going to feel so good either. But if I give the most I can, I tend to feel good. You know? And so I think that Kate, you know, tonight, tomorrow night, in the week, she'll be able to rejoice because she gave us a lot. You know, she gave us the most she could. And that's what I sense from Anushka and I also. So when I'm in the plane tomorrow evening, going back home, my sense is I'm going to be happy, you know, that I gave the most I could, you know, supported the most beautiful way I could, you know, not more. If I had given too much, then I would be in the plane exhausted, resentful, confused. I don't want this, we don't want this for anybody. So, thank you for this. And bon appétit. And in the silence, that is still very much the vehicle here. Thank you. Do you need to explain some of the specifics, or it's self-explanatory?
It's self-explanatory. Yeah, is that okay?
Yeah. Like outside.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Yeah. So you'll see for the dana.